From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made at the Dr. Charles T. Lunsford School, number 19 in the city of Rochester. Democrat and Chronicle reporter Justin Murphy tells the story of that school's principal, Monique Silas Lee, who has a short commute home. She walks just a few blocks. She can get home in 5 minutes by foot. Why is this story so newsworthy? Well, because, as Murphy notes in a new investigation, it's so unusual. Most of the highest-paid Rochester City School District employees do not live in the city. They live in the suburbs. And as Murphy notes, that means the salaries they carry benefit mostly white school districts that enjoy much nicer resources. And while 84% of Rochester school administrators live outside the city, it's teachers, too. Murphy reports that 82% of Rochester teachers don't live in the district. Most live in the suburbs. And what about incentive programs meant to attract employees to the city? Murphy reports it's essentially not working. He spoke to Simeon Bannister, the vice president of community programs at the Rochester Area Community Foundation, who has been the most consistent local voice in pointing out the impact of residency, whether it's police, teachers, otherwise. Bannister said, quote, "People can live wherever they want, but there is a cost. The effect of having that money leave the city of Rochester every year only deepens the level of disparity that exists," end quote. And so what, if anything, can be done about this? Our guests include education reporter for the Democrat and Chronicle, Justin Murphy, who's back with us. Thanks for being back with us, Justin.
Hi, Evan.
Simeon Bannister is the vice president of community programs at the Rochester Area Community Foundation. Simeon, thanks for making time for the program.
Good to be with you.
And the president of the Rochester Teachers Association is Adam Urbanski. Adam, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Justin, let me just start with you and understand a little bit of the historical context. You talked to Bill Clark, member of the Rochester School Board, who notes that it was, what, a quarter century ago that I think he wrote an op-ed in which he was noting that at the time, 60% of administrators in the Rochester City School District lived in the suburbs. Well, now if it's 84%, we certainly can infer that this is becoming more extreme over time. I mean, is that how you see it?
Yeah, for certain. And in fact, a generation before Bill wrote that essay, it was a hot topic in the school district when they had a short-lived and fairly unsuccessful attempt to enforce a residency requirement on administrators. So this is not something that the district maintains or has ever presented very detailed information on. So it's hard to track it back all the way, but from what's available, it certainly seems that it's been worsening, as one would expect from the general demographic patterns of the community.
And your research indicates that while it's a very high number of administrators and teachers generally, there are some categories of Rochester City School District employees who do, by percentage, more often live in the city than not. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's right. So if you look at the classes of employees in the district and the four bargaining units, administrators is one. And as you mentioned, that's 84% live in the suburbs and teachers 82%. But then there's two others. One is called Bente, and that's non-educators, your custodians and things of that nature. And they are about, I think, 50-50. And then there's another union for teacher assistants and paraprofessionals. And most of those folks live in the city. And of course, you can infer from that the financial breakdown. And so people who earn in, say, the top 10% of salaries in the district, only 15% of them live in the city, whereas in the very bottom 10% of the district, 68% live in the city. And, you know, that, too, is not surprising because we all know that people with the means to move to the suburbs often do. And we all know, of course, that that also has a racial component in Rochester and other metropolitan areas.
So generally speaking, the less money you make if you work in the RCSD, the more likely you live in the city. The more money you make, the more likely you live in the suburbs.
That's right. And in fact, one thing that surprised me as I was looking at this data was that is true even if you control for job category and seniority. So there's maybe like a 3% difference if you take, I looked at English teachers in RCSD who earn in the 50th percentile of salary among English teachers, which means that they have approximately the same seniority those who live in the suburbs earn a few thousand dollars more than in the city. That was surprising to me. The district's HR department thinks that may be a result of people moving to the suburbs as they begin to earn more money, but it's a pretty consistent effect throughout the entire employee population.
So, Simeon Bannister, as you said in the piece, there is a cost to this. Explain, because some listeners might hear this and go, okay, but, you know, so what?
Yeah, so first let me just start with a quick tip of the hat to Justin and the team at the Democrat and Chronicle. Anybody with a keen eye that's watching the papers these days knows that there's been a market shift. I'm really excited about some of the ways that we're telling stories and some of the things that we're starting to cover. And this is a really important issue that we need to wrestle with. The reason why, at least from my perspective, sometimes things that can be aha moments, insights, start with very mundane moments. In my case, that was me spilling something on my tie. I was in my office just outside of downtown Rochester, and I spilled something on my tie. And it occurred to me that the only place that I could go to get a new necktie for that day, the only place that I could think of was the outlet store at Hickey Freeman in city limits. And as I started to ponder what that meant, I started to think about other areas where you couldn't purchase or couldn't engage in any kind of commerce in the city. My friend Eric Van Dusen over at ESL Charitable Foundation at the time was working for NeighborWorks, and he gave me the language for this. He said that what we have is a collapsed market. And a collapsed market means that there's essentially differential opportunity in the city for commerce than what you find in our surrounding communities. And no economic opportunity, right, that differential level of commerce, the upshot of it is that there's fewer jobs. And if there are fewer jobs and we have an under-resourced system and an under-resourced set of interventions that happen in the city of Rochester, then we know that what that looks like. It's people turning to illegal trades to try to figure out how to get by. It's folks that have to depend on other forms of income to just figure out how to get by, because the economic base in the city, it translates into things like improvised families. Many of the things that a lot of folks that were in the comment section under Justin's article that they were decrying, the crime in the city, the terrible things that are happening in the city, all a function of the collapsed marketplace. How did we get here? Well, we got here because of historical exclusion through redlining, restrictive zoning, and other policy decisions at the federal, state, and local level. We know that it was accelerated white flight, and that as that process has played out over decades, that it has created a very virulent situation. Now, some people say lots of money comes into the city of Rochester. The school district gets $1 billion. City is getting a ton of money, and so on and so forth. But in many instances, those dollars are money that masquerades as aid to the city. But when you look at whose pocket those dollars actually end up in, it tends to be suburban dwellers. And so money that is earmarked, quote unquote, for the city actually ends up in reality becoming economic stimulus for many of our surrounding communities. And so I have heard many folks say that poverty is the real challenge that we need to engage, that parent engagement in the education context is really what we need to talk about if we want to improve academic performance. I would argue back that the root cause is this set of circumstances that we see. And if we can't deal with that, then a conversation about poverty and parenting all of a sudden becomes a red herring of an argument.
Adam Urbanski, can you offer me two sets of ideas? Number one, do you agree that it's a problem that most Rochester teachers live in the suburbs, not the city? And do you have any thoughts about why that is?
Well, I suspect that we all agree on the analysis. And I think that the piece that Justin wrote is a very good contribution. The real question is, what can be done to ameliorate the situation? Because on the one hand, it is neither doable nor practical nor desirable to compel people to live in a certain area. I don't think that this would be a good solution for our students. I think we're we should do everything we can to expand the prospective pool of outstanding and caring educators rather than to limit it artificially or by compulsion. On the other hand, living in the community where you work is a good thing. That is my choice and has been my choice. I live in a city. I choose to live in a city. I love living in a city. But that's not the choice of everybody. And that should not actually determine the entirety of our opinion of the person or the family. I just don't think it's a practical thing to require residency regulations. There may be some things we can do. There may be incentives that we can provide, but compelling people to live in a certain area is a proposal that would backfire on the children who are in public schools in the city of Rochester.
Justin Murphy, the incentive ideas in the past, you report, just haven't worked, right?
Yeah, so the main thing that RCSD has tried is a rule in the 80s where all administrators, in most cases, had to live in the city. And it was disobeyed in spirit and in letter until it became unpracticable to try it further. It has happened elsewhere, the most prominent example being Milwaukee, which had a residency requirement for a very long time. And there's a pretty full spectrum of choices that you could use, both carrots and sticks, to try to compel teachers or other employees to live in the city. But and I know Simeon has some ideas on the most effective of them, but they've all got downsides as well.
Simeon, what do you make of what you heard from Adam Urbanski there?
Yeah, so I mean, I didn't come on this afternoon to make an argument for residency requirements specifically, but I think that the analysis, if we can all agree that at the root cause we have collapsed markets that need to be addressed, that we need to figure out ways to channel more dollars into the hands of, not just into the city, quote unquote, but into the hands of people that have traditionally been excluded. If we can agree on that, then that means that a set of steps need to follow. So we need to start the conversation really, to me, at things like asking, Mr. Mansky kind of notes that the children would suffer. I'd like to unpack that a little bit. I want to know what he means by that. I think he's suggesting that the teaching pool would be too contract. That's an argument that's often made about residency requirements. I wonder if even today the credentialing process, the fact that you have to have a master's education in order to be a teacher, doesn't necessarily square with the experience that many of us have going into classrooms and watching those paraprofessionals that are paid half to a third of what even some of the teachers are, who are so responsible for classroom behavioral management and some of those techniques. I wonder if there's some credentialing conversations we need to have, and whether the credentials themselves pose the barrier for who can access that opportunity for employment. I wonder if, just to put a few other things on the table, there's a colloquial term, the commuter tax, but it's actually a better way to describe it as a tax on non-resident income. Some folks argue, hey, listen, that's a pretty radical or outlandish idea, except when you phrased it as a tax on non-resident income, we realize that the United States of America has a tax on non-resident income. If you come into the country from other places and you work a certain number of days, you pay income taxes here in the United States. The state of New York, if you live in New Jersey or Connecticut or some other place and you come to New York over 180 days, you pay New York State taxes. And so it's not beyond the pale to say that if folks are gathering and garnering the majority of their income from the city, that that's another way to mobilize some resources that we can drive back into developing the city, because all of us have a vested interest And I think that's the point that can't get lost. This is, I saw, again, in some of the comments, a little bit of a duality or binary, city versus the suburbs. Actually, if we take a step back and we think on the broader sense, all of us have a role, have a benefit here, because when we have a community that is well-resourced, when we have a community that has economic parity, then it creates the requisite economic momentum through the committee, through the community, rather. A rising tide does indeed lift all boats. So the residency requirement is one strategy, but there are several others.
Adam Urbanski, can you respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm interested in hearing specific suggestions from Mr. Bannister and from others on how to ameliorate the situation. But a couple of thoughts. One is we probably should all recognize that this is not a dynamic or a predicament that is particular to Rochester only. This is probably the pattern in virtually all metropolitan areas in our country and maybe throughout the world. That's one point. So maybe there is some benchmarking that would be helpful here. Maybe we can actually seek out good examples of good solutions, or at least good proposals to ameliorate the situation. So I think we want the same end result. The question, really the challenge here, is how do you get to that, to that goal? Because sometimes, even with good intentions, we could make the situation worse. You're right, Mr. Bannister. I do mean that if we got a residency requirement right now, it would hurt the students that we teach in the city schools, because it would limit the pool, and you would then exclude lots of committed, dedicated, caring educators, competent educators, simply because it's unrealistic for them to unilaterally select where they live. I mean, supposing I teach in the city schools, and supposing my spouse teaches in Fairport schools, and supposing both the city schools and the Fairport schools have equal requirements for residency. Are you now suggesting that you have to have separate households or an additional residence? It's really not practical for the employer to dictate the private lives and private choices of all the families that are affected by their employees. So incentives is one category of issues. There may be some other legislative relief or intervention that could be helpful. But I just am cautioning against, with all good intent, providing solutions that turn out to actually reduce the quality of both the providers of services and of the services just because of a one-size-fits-all requirement that intrudes on private choices of families.
Simeon Bannister?
Yeah, so, I mean, if we take I heard 3 points in that rejoinder. And so if we take them one by one, I think the notion of dictating the personal lives of folks is a little bit of a canard. We know that, for example, the city of Rochester already has a residency requirement, and a number of municipalities, as was mentioned earlier, including a little closer to home, up in Niagara Falls. Buffalo also had recently, as 2013, a residency requirement. As I one time heard, I think it was the former mayor of Milwaukee say, folks have the right to live wherever they want, but it doesn't mean that they have a right to automatic public employment, particularly if that public employment is being done in a way that it has a negative impact on the entire community. I think the thing that we might agree on is the limitation question. And so I think that we do need to expand the pool of who can be teachers. And I hope that folks agree that many of the paraprofessionals, the workers that are in some of our out of school time and summer programming, have all the skills, but for the artificial credential that one could argue, I would like to see some data, and I've never seen any data that substantiates the need for some of the credentialing that's in place. And one could argue that by expanding the pool in that way, that would give us a whole bevy of other folks that could participate in the teaching arena and would bring a lot of credibility with students because of the fact that they live proximate and represent the same cultural backgrounds as many of our teachers. And again, there is a bevy of data that suggests that cultural representation in classrooms does matter. On the incentive side, I think that all the evidence that we have is that the incentives haven't worked. We know that here in the city of Rochester City School District, it's offered incentives for mortgage down payments and other approaches to try to encourage, cajole, coax folks into living in the city of Rochester, and that hasn't played out. So I don't know that that's the solution that we can offer if we're going to look at each of the potential options on the merits. I think we'd have to look at something else. And then the last piece and the first comment the last point I'll make is about the pattern. I think he's right that there's a pattern in all metro areas around the country. He also threw in throughout the world. Actually, I don't know that that's true throughout the world. Actually, what's fascinating is that in other places, we don't see some of those same kinds of patterns in other countries around the world. And I think it's because of the unique history of structural racism and how it's played out in this country that we see these patterns in city after city after city across the country. We know, for example, that the Federal Highway Department adapted a policy of quote-unquote slum clearance using inner city roadways, and that that happened right here in Rochester in the late 60s with the construction of the inner loop, a right that we are wrong that we're currently trying to right with redeveloping some of that land area. That same pattern, that same history is indeed the groundwater, if you will, that exists all across the country. And because we see those same patterns, because we see those same trends, you know, my job is to think about what's happening here in this community, here in Rochester, and what strategies we have locally that we can use. And again, you know, residence requirement is but one. Tax on non-resident income is another. And I think if we can agree to the fact that something needs to be done, then we ought to get organized to make it happen. And I think as a community, broadly speaking, we ought to expect some accountability until something does happen that's different than what we currently have.
Well, and Simeon, let me just follow up, because I know Adam will want to follow up as well, but I just want to make sure I understand a point that you're making about credentials. You know, different states have different rules about who can become a public school teacher. When you talk about the high bar for credentialing of teachers, you talk about master's degrees. Do you think that districts simply just need more freedom to decide, I want to hire who I want to be a teacher, even if they don't have a master's, even if they don't have the credentials that are currently in place? Is it as much as just giving districts a much, much more freedom to do that, or do you see a different set of standards that you would adopt here?
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to see evidence that the master's credential correlates to better academic performance. I think as we look at our own school district, it doesn't suggest to me, and perhaps others have differing opinions, I'd be curious to see some data, some information that substantiates that claim. If indeed we can agree that that credential is not correlate to academic success, then that requires us to then be thoughtful about, what are the characteristics that lead to stronger and better academic performance. And there is some data that I've seen, and I know that others continue to contribute to it, that body of data that says that things like cultural representation, being proximate to students, that there are other characteristics that matter. And so certainly not a knock on our educational framing now, but I think that it's at least a conversation that we need to have. And that then removes the concern, at least in some part, about the limited pool of folks that can qualify for the teaching profession.
Adam, what do you think? Is it time to really change the credentialing process and give more flexibility for districts like Rochester?
Well, I'm open to all conversations, including the ones to which ultimately will not be able to agree. But, you know, Mr. Bannister would not be making the same argument if we were talking about some other profession, like medicine, for example, that maybe we don't need a medical degree, or maybe we don't need board certification for physicians, or for pilots, or for engineers, or for architects. So I would caution anyone who wants to rush to lower the standards for qualification.
I'm not sure he thinks it's lowering the standards. I think he says he wants to see evidence that the standards are achieving the results that they purport to achieve. And if they're not, okay, then wouldn't they make a change?
I would support that. I would support that kind of inquiry. I would be interested in seeing it also. And I'm not ascribing any ill will to the proposal. I just want to put it in perspective. Usually those conversations about teaching and whether or not the credentials matter is sort of an automatic impulse, because teaching is not viewed as a genuine profession like medicine, for example, or law or engineering or architecture. So I'm just offering a caution about that. But yes, I would like to see some evidence of that. And I think there are other things to increase the pool of locally developed professionals other than by focusing on credentials alone. For example, we have a teaching and learning institute at East High School where we actually, quote, grow our own, unquote, teachers. The district for many years has supported paraprofessionals and teaching assistants with tuition support by funding their education to become teachers. The district stopped doing that, but it's something that the district could resume doing, because it's absolutely true that this is a very promising potential source of teachers. And our paraprofessionals and teacher aides and teaching assistants are indeed undervalued and underpaid, and they can and should be supported to a path for those who want to do that to become teachers. So there are many things we could do. There is no single lever, but I would caution against getting stuck on credentials, because it might lead to lowering the standards for a very important occupation that should be viewed as any other profession.
Okay, and I got to get to phone calls, but I'll just let Simeon Bannister respond. Are you concerned that if there's a good faith effort to be more flexible here, that as Adam Urbanski says, we could see a lowering of standards here, Simeon?
Again, I just want to see some data. I mean, if the data suggests that that's the case, then we can, you know, have a conversation about it. But I've not seen any data that would stipulate that that's the case. I'm glad that Adam is open to that conversation and exploring it. One piece I do want to just, you know, make a tangential note on is the idea of the Grow Your Own programs, because I think that that's a fertile area, but it's one that has kind of, in some sense, overpromised and underdelivered over the years. And I think it's because we're not taking into account some of the factors that cause attrition in the ranks, like, for example, standardized tests that aren't culturally relevant, and so we lose some of the potential applicants through that process. We know that many of the schools of education are not proximate to the community. You've got to drive, you know, 40 minutes, 30 minutes to be able to even get to class. And so we've got some attrition that happens there. So if we're going to have a serious conversation about, you know, the Grow Your Own programs, then that's a really, you know, then we need to really kind of think about how we're going to remobilize resources. And that in many ways is the kind of root of what I would, you know, offer. And by the way, I don't want, you know, Mr. Bansky or anybody else to think that we're just picking on teachers. Number one, I have the utmost respect for the profession. My mother was a teacher, as he knows. My mom and him were teachers together at Franklin High School back when some of these policies even came to being back in the 80s. And so I have the utmost respect for the profession. and recognize that there is a unique skill set. The thing I wonder is whether that master's credential actually captures that skill set. And then a little closer to where I live, we're asking the same questions in other professions, frankly. So we're looking at certainly the nonprofit arena and asking about the demographics that make up the staffing for organizations. One has to wonder if your organization, your entity, doesn't have any representation from the communities that are being served. There's data that's emerging that suggests that there's questions about effectiveness even in those ranks. So there are, to sum this up, actually, if you add together the nonprofit sector, if you add in the education and public sector, if you add in the private sector, our math tells us, working with one of the institutes at SUNY Brockport, that right now we have an extractive economy. $3.3 billion is leaving the city of Rochester every year in income and benefits and ending up in our surrounding suburban communities. And that's just a recipe for the level of differential economies that just undermine our region's competitiveness. And after maybe some questions, I'm happy to share a little bit more detail about how we know that our region's competitiveness is being undermined.
We should have just took both hours for this. And that's what Justin Murphy has done for us, education reporter for the Democrat and Chronicle. And if you are a subscriber to your local newspaper, you are supporting this kind of journalism, and every city in the country has seen newspapers scale back. But we're grateful for this kind of work and this kind of conversation. Justin is here. Simeon Bannister, Vice President of Community Programs at the Rochester Area Community Foundation. Adam Urbanski, President of the Rochester Teachers Association. And me and everyone, I think everyone working on the show and on the show today, are city residents. Just looking at the numbers. Your phone calls after this only break. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections. Three more candidates for Rochester City Council join us first hour. There are more than a dozen candidates on the ballot this year. We help you get to know them on Connections each Wednesday. In our second hour, summer camps preparing to come back. Can they do it safely? Can they do it before kids get vaccinated? How are they planning? We talk summer camp on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. To the phones we go, Rajesh in Rochester first. Go ahead, Rajesh.
Hi, I'm a teacher, former teacher in RCSD, and I don't think the master's degree is that important. It didn't serve me well. In fact, as a minority student in education circles, and I ran into so many roadblocks and gatekeepers getting the master's degree as someone who spoke their mind and represented, you know, minority thought and different, you know, non-capitalist thinking. I was, you know, it was very difficult to get the master's degree. And also, we have to recognize that there's been no scientific evidence that's shown any progress as far as recruitment or diversity in the staff. There's been none. And Adam Urbanski is very scientific in his approach, but yet he's got big blinders to the decades of lack of diversity. And it's an occupation. My father came from an occupation. He was from a colonized state where the British taught the Indians what to think, how to think. And when they taught them that, you know, finally geography, that the British were way over here, that's when the revolution happened. That's when the decolonial relationship ended. And what we have is an occupation the same. It's a colonial relationship between the white suburban employees and the minority students, and we have to recognize that. And I commend Simeon for putting the arguments together in a scientific, rational way. I wish Adam Urbanski wouldn't throw these like loopy ideas that have no like bearing on reality, you know, especially for black and brown people in the city. So that's my comment.
All right, thank you, Rajesh. Adam Urbanski, go ahead.
Well, ironically, I mean, I agree with the spirit of the caller's comments. We definitely do need to diversify the teacher and educator force in Rochester. I had been trying to get the district to actually include some of our best teachers, particularly teachers of color, to take the lead on these excursions that they make to recruit at historically black colleges and other places to diversify our teacher force, but the district has not taken us up on the offer, and I hope that maybe they will soon. But to say that we have not been trying to diversify is uninformed. We have been. It's the district that has the authority to hire and chooses not to take recommendations that are more promising than the protocols that they're engaging in right now. So, yes, we should continue to diversify and to recruit teachers of color. But remember, persons of color, just like women, have more choices now than they historically have had and are choosing other occupations. And the best way to diversify is to make teaching more attractive in a particular district, in a particular urban district, so that we would have a shot, a competitive shot, at enticing people to come and teach in an urban environment.
Okay. I'm going to get back to your phone calls because there are quite a bit. This is Megan in let's see here. Megan, I don't know where you're coming. I think you're in Rochester. Go ahead, Megan.
Yeah, I'm in Rochester. So okay. I'm actually a graduate of Rochester City School District. My parents chose Rochester. We moved from downstate Queens because they wanted an urban area for my brother and I to grow up. I'm a teacher in the Rochester City School District. And when I started teaching, I lived in the neighborhood I grew up in. And when I decided to buy a house, I couldn't find a house I could afford. So as a young teacher, you know, a lot of people think teachers get paid an enormous amount of money. But as a young teacher, I was incapable of buying a house in any neighborhood that I looked at. And I've lived all over the city. I did end up having to move outside of the city. I live only about three blocks from the city line, choosing to stay as close to an urban area as possible. So I know that there are a lot of my friends and colleagues who have also had that same issue where we've had to look for very low house. If we wanted to not live in an apartment and to buy a house and invest and raise our families, that we had to leave those areas of the city that we had looked. And on another note, there's also a possible concern of gentrification. I mean, the neighborhood I grew up in, a few other neighborhoods I'm aware of, have become gentrified. I mean, they have turned into impossible places to buy a house unless you're very well established and make, you know, six figures almost in certain areas. I mean, there's just no way that I could aspire to live there. Most of my friends and I miss the city. I mean, I'm in the city all the time. My parents still live in the city. Most of my money goes to the city. I'm not thrilled about suburban life. I prefer to spend my time in city neighborhoods. And thankfully, because I work there, I spend the majority of my time there.
Okay.
Well, so I think sometimes it's not. Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, no. I appreciate it, Megan. And I want to make sure there's time for our guests to respond. And I want to start with Justin Murphy on this one. Go ahead, Justin. Oh, you maybe, yeah, there you are. Go ahead.
Yeah, just to, you know, this is tends to be, if I can kind of generalize on this call and what we've been talking about, this is how we address this problem in general is trying to prevail upon teachers to stay in the city if we give them a few thousand dollars or, you know, maybe parents will feel guilty about moving to the suburbs and instead they'll stay in the city and put the onus on individuals to kind of sort through their own circumstances. But as we've talked about all throughout the hour, that's not how these problems began. These were all problems that began through policy, through governmental action. You know, one of the things that was striking to me that I ended my story with Monique Silas Lee, the principal at School 19, is that she saw some of her students near the school on a weekend and they said, "What are you still doing here?" And she said, "Well, I live here." And they didn't believe her.
Wow.
And they didn't believe her until they saw her on her porch a few days later. You know, and it's not just that, like, "Oh, I didn't know you lived here." It's like, there's no way a person who is, you know, an experienced, respected, well-compensated professional educator would live in the same neighborhood as me. You know, that's kind of the larger point that comes out of not just this specific instance of teacher residency, but kind of the entire dichotomy that communities like Rochester have set up. And that's not something that you can that you can fix by thinking of ways to shuffle people back and forth, or distribute across two particular areas of the community. Another way to go about doing that, which I didn't really get into in the story, is that you can decrease the salience of those segregating lines. And that, again, is a government job, and that's a job to be handled on a regional level. That's not something that you do with specific individuals in specific job titles.
Hmm. Well, on the back end of that, Megan was mentioning a concern about gentrification, and I want to ask Simeon and Adam if they want to respond to some of the call. And while I send this over to Simeon, I will also note that a listener named Todd sends me a note saying, if all of the city employees lived in the city, talking teachers, admins, police, fire, everyone, where would they be housed, and would the next problem be a complaint of gentrification? Simeon.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting issue that we really do need to dig into and be thoughtful about. I tend to think about things like that as bridges that we cross when we get to them. That would be a much better problem for us to have to deal with than what currently exists, which is the extractive economy that leaves folks in really desolate situations in terms of the resources. I'm certainly mindful, though, that the changing economic dynamics could be problematic, except to say that if we pair this with the idea of relaxing some of these credentials, and today we've talked about the school district, but the same thing is true in the public sector and some other areas, the police and fire. Where some of the regimes for civil service beg some questions about their fairness. And then also we know that hiring bias still is very predominant and is something that we continue to need to engage in this community. If you pair more expanded economic opportunity, the question isn't how do you delimit poverty. The question is how do we create economic opportunity where indeed a rising tide does lift all boats, where you can stay in your neighborhood and also have jobs that are proximate to where you live so that, again, economic opportunity is shared. And what we know is that communities that are embracing these kinds of practices, the Urban Institute did a report back in 2018, updated it last year, that shows that municipalities that are embracing racially inclusive and economically inclusive practices enjoy stronger economies. And so the argument to be made here is that if we don't figure this out, then we risk languishing in the same historical circumstances that have undermined the growth of our region. Just really quick, one example of that, I'll give you a couple examples, if you don't mind, really quickly. One is that we can see that in many ways our healthcare system is destabilized, in part because the Medicaid reimbursement rate can't keep up with the expenses. And so one option is to, try to treat fewer Medicaid patients, which would be morally reprehensible. Another option is how do we lean into create an economy where fewer people need to be on Medicaid, mm-hmm. We can see it at the county level. When we look at the county budget, we know that 76% of it is going to social services, is going to public safety and criminal justice, and going to health, in some ways remedial expenses for not having equity on the front end. If folks want to see regional growth, if you want your taxes lowered, try equity. And so there are a number of strategies that help us to get closer. And I think it's really about time for us to reframe the conversation in this community from just this problem that we have to solve and, this challenge. I know that a lot of callers might be in the doldrums right now thinking about some of this. Hey, listen, turn that frown upside down. Smile, because this is an opportunity that we get to realize to reinvest in our region in different ways that help us set us on the trajectory for growth.
Adam Urbanski, go ahead.
Very quickly, I want to mention two things. One is that in this effort, we have potentially a credibility problem because you cannot teach what you do not model. And out of the entire cabinet of the Rochester City School District, the top administrators, only two individuals live in the city. And those two don't include the superintendent either. We don't begrudge her the right to live wherever she chooses to live, but you cannot push for teachers and school-level administrators to have to live in a city and other employees when you cannot meet that requirement yourself. Secondly, I just want to mention the elephant in this room. And the elephant in this room is that if we are really a community, Monroe County community, why are we totally omitting a conversation about a metropolitan school system? Why are we leaving the current predicament, the structural predicament, intact and talking about rearranging things within those confines? So I think to have an honest conversation, let's talk about the division, the hard lines dividing the city from the rest of the county.
Okay. Every time I feel like 5 minutes has passed, I feel like we need a different hour for each individual subject that's coming up. I mean, there's a lot here. I'm going to try to squeeze in one more here. John in Fairport has been waiting. Go ahead, John.
Yes, hello. Thank you. So I think the elephant in the room, it really started out as a discussion on finances for the city and money leaving the city. And I think the real problem does lie in poverty in the city. And I think that has been created over the way that our social support systems have been designed for generations. And, I think we need to change that. And I had an idea that I think a lot of people maybe could better their lives or family lives by being able to get a job, earn more money, and not be worried about losing the services, because I don't really know what the exact calculation is, but a lot of people do, and they know that if they earn too much money, they're going to lose services. And I think we'd be better off letting people earn what they can, get in the workforce, better themselves, and that would help lift people out of poverty. And then I think the city would become a place where a lot more people would be comfortable living in.
All right. Thank you for the phone call, John. Simeon Bannister, go ahead.
Yeah, and so I think a couple of things. The first is that there was a lot of vitriol online with folks kind of decrying the conditions in the city. And, folks that live in the city know that some of that is, in fact, the vast majority of it is grossly overblown. Most city dwellers feel safe in their homes. They do not feel like someone is shooting at you every night. They do not feel like it's a war-torn environment. We certainly have issues that we need to confront. There's no doubt about it, but because one is too many. But on the whole, I think that when I hear some of that kind of rhetoric, it harkens me back to some of the images. There's a field called semiotics that describes the potency of images and what we see and how that then influences our behaviors and what we believe. And much of what we see about urban dwelling is that it's dangerous, unsafe, and frankly, I just don't know that that's true. So let's start there. But besides that, I do think that an interesting point is to be made, which I was describing, is what folks in the business call the benefits cliff. And there's a reasonable conversation to have about how we overcome the benefits cliff, which basically creates a disincentive for folks to be able to kind of continue their economic climb out of the most virulent circumstances of poverty, because you do lose housing, you lose access to benefits, and unfortunately the wages that folks earn are insufficient to allow to be able to afford housing, food, transportation, et cetera, that we all know are necessary. So these concerns that are raised are not reasons to stop having the conversation, I think. And I think that's what pains me in our community, is that far too often objections get raised and then we just kind of stop. And I think it's time for us to kind of continue not only to talk about it, but let's try some things. Let's put some things into practice here in this community. Let's take some action, and then we can do the work that we need to measure and understand the progress that we've made or have not made, and continue to iterate. This is a community, and what I love about Rochester, we have a little bit of a duality. On one hand, we have what we've described this hour, but we also have this legacy of innovation, of social progress. And it seems to me that I'd like for our community to continue to lean into that part of our identity. And my hope is that in so doing, we're prepared to take the kinds of actions that will leave us a more vibrant and verdant community.
All right, about a minute and a half. Adam Urbanski, go ahead.
That I want to agree with Mr. Bannister. And I also want to commend Justin Murphy for his continued excellence in journalism in raising these conversations. So maybe what we should do is figure out how we can all work together to ameliorate the situation. We probably won't find a single lever that will fix everything. But I agree with Mr. Bannister. Let's work together and do something that would actually put us on a road towards improving the status quo, because it does need improvement. And I think since we share the same goal, which is diversifying and making it more real to life, our work along with our personal lives, I think we can probably make progress together.
Justin Murphy.
Evan, can I just chime in really super quick?
You got it.
So there's an urgency to this moment, though, right? We have more dollars that are flowing into this community as a result of the federal stimulus than we have ever seen in this community's history. $1.9 trillion stimulus, that's bigger than the ARRA and the Great Depression dollars, the New Deal put together. If we can leverage those resources in a smart way, through inclusive recovery, we can use this moment as a catapult to change things.
Hey,
and I do want to give a shout out to my man, Justin Murphy.
Inclusive recovery. We should come back and talk about that soon, shouldn't we?
Absolutely.
Okay. There's an invitation. Simeon Bannister is the Vice President of Community Programs at the Rochester Area Community Foundation. Thank you, Simeon.
You got it.
Adam Urbanski, always generous with his time, as the President of the Rochester Teachers Association. Thank you, Adam.
My pleasure.
Justin Murphy, education reporter for the Democrat and Chronicle. Please find his work there and subscribe if you feel like you want to support journalism. Thanks, Justin.
But don't feel obligated to read the comments, Simeon.
Never read the comments. Megan Mack, Rob Braden, Evan Dawson saying thanks. Talk to you tomorrow.